Hi, this is Alan Shartok, delighted to be in conversation today with my old friend and colleague, maybe my best friend as a matter of fact, Dr. Gerald Benjamin, director of the Center for Research, Regional Education and Outreach at the State University of New York at New Paltz. Dr. Benjamin also serves as the Associate Vice President for Regional Engagement. Jerry and his team are conducting some exciting research that is bearing regionally and statewide, dealing with education, economic impact, the arts, research evaluation of health, GIS mapping projects, and more. Gerald Benjamin joined the New Paltz faculty as an assistant professor of political science in 1968 and achieved the university's highest rank in 2002 when he was appointed distinguished professor by the SUNY Board of Trustees. He served as chair of the Department of Political Science, presiding officer of the faculty, and for 12 years beginning in 1996, dean of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. The College of Liberal Arts and Sciences is the largest, most complex academic unit at SUNY New Paltz. During Benjamin's time as dean, the faculty of the college grew in numbers and diversity and underwent extensive renewal. Additionally, the college was placed on sound organizational and financial footing, and numerous major and minor programs were added and or revitalized. Among the most notable was an interdisciplinary major in Asian studies, which is where I came in 1971. Associate Vice President Benjamin earned a BA with distinction from St. Lawrence University, his master's in 1967 and doctoral work in 1970 in political science are from Columbia University. Welcome, my old friend, Jerry Benjamin. Just great to see you.
Delighted to be here with you today, Alan.
What kind of family upbringing did you have?
I'm from a working-class Jewish family in Brooklyn, and when we made it, we moved to Rockaway in Queens.
But you never got as far as Long Island.
No, we were drifting toward Long Island, but we never got there.
Your father was interesting. He was a cop.
Yeah, he had several careers. He was a professional basketball player. He was a police officer. He was a salesman. His final career was retail. He had a retail liquor store downtown and on 31st Street between Broadway and 6th Avenue. It was, when he first bought it, crime was so problematic in the neighborhood that the door was locked and a customer had to knock on the door to be let in.
Wow. Just like the jewelry stores. Amazing. He was legendary. He was a profound influence in your life. We all knew the stories of Ruby because that's what his name was.
Right. Ruby's rules.
What were some of Ruby's rules?
Well, when you make the sale, pick up and leave. Stop talking.
In other words, just shut up. Donna right. Frank at WAMC has said to me many times, never ask anybody whether something is working or not, because, you know, you might get an answer you don't want.
If you want something, don't be afraid to ask for it, but don't be afraid to quit if you don't get it.
That's a Rubyism.
Right.
How about your mom?
My mom was the first college-educated person in her family. She had four siblings. Her dad was a tailor from Poland, and her mom was a woman who had no formal education and could not read or write.
Did she go to City College?
She went to Brooklyn College. She, I think, was one of the very early graduating classes at Brooklyn College.
Amazing. And how did the relationship between the two of them, Ruby and your mom, play out in terms of your sense of, you know, doing what you've done so well all your life?
Well, first of all, they were as almost a caricature of Jewish family life. They were very oriented toward education. There was a presumption that we would go to college, and no question that that would happen. They were very educationally oriented. But interestingly, my dad was very sensitive to not putting pressure on his kids. He was very strong physically and had a volatile dimension to his character, so he was always in check.
But you mean in personal check, his own check?
Yeah, his own check. But he modeled by example. He was very, very competitive, very oriented towards sports, very achievement-oriented. And she was the classic nurturing person. So I think that probably the most interesting thing about them was that they believed you should pursue your interests and passion. They didn't place expectations on you, on their kids, by way of saying, well, you're going to be a teacher. No, you're going to be a lawyer. You're going to be a this. You're going to be a that. Hmm. And I found as dean that I was often had to speak to parents about assuring their own kids' success by allowing their kids to find and pursue their passion rather than imposing a goal on them that they might not share.
Hmm. You have a brother, Arthur the dentist.
Arthur's more than a dentist. He's one of the great dental surgeons in New York and maybe in the country.
Wow.
Yeah, he's.
Did he work on your teeth?
It's interesting. When he first became a dentist, he had his own office, and I said, "This guy's got to make a living. I can't go downstate and ask him to take care of me because he wouldn't charge me anything." Indeed, he doesn't to this day charge me anything. So for years, I didn't come see him, and it turned out that he told me many years later that I thought he wasn't a good enough dentist to take care of me. In fact, I was trying to be discreet and not impose on him. So yes, he does. I see him frequently from the dental chair. I think that it's a fair trade. I don't pay for dental care, but when he's got my mouth full of all that stuff, he can talk to me and he doesn't have to pay for therapy.
Oh, of course, they all do that. You know, it's very interesting. My Aunt Dee Dee, my mother's sister, was married to a man who became LaGuardia's dentist. What do you think his first name was?
Fiorello.
Arthur. It was Arthur. I never made that connection. Very interesting. And when he died, he loved shoes, Arthur, my uncle, and we got this huge box of shoes, everything from white box and, you know, stuff. They were size too large, but we'd wear them one day and we'd throw them out. We'd take them on Boy Scout hikes and things like that. So, Jerry, when did you decide you were going to become a political scientist?
Well, you know, I took a government class at St. Lawrence by a guy named Harry Reif. And Harry Reif was legendary for his difficulty and demanding character. And I just found that I liked the subject a lot, and I majored in it. It was a history and government department, so I majored in American history and government. But that was fundamental. And then when I was finishing college and trying to decide, in those days, in the mid-60s, people actually did what they wanted. They didn't worry about getting a job.
I remember that very well. Yeah.
I went to graduate school, and I told my dad I wanted to go to graduate school, and he said, great. And when I got into and decided to go to Columbia, he couldn't have been more proud because he was a New Yorker all his life, and Columbia was the apex of New York academic life. So he would love to come up and meet me at Columbia and take me to supper. And we played ball in the Teachers College gym every Monday night, so that was very, very wonderful. But I sort of followed an intellectual path defined in college without really thinking too hard about it.
I'm sorry?
I didn't think hard about choice. It just was a natural unfolding.
What you wanted to do.
Yeah.
Did you meet people back in the day who became friends and who are still friends?
Well, here we are talking to each other.
Yeah.
But I'm still in touch with some of my boyhood friends from the neighborhood.
You told me a story once about your grade school teacher who had an opaque projector. Can you tell me that?
My high school teacher. I went to Brooklyn Technical High School, where I recently returned for a reunion, which was quite interesting.
What year was that? What number?
It's a very famous year. It's the only year that reads the same upside down as right side up.
Which is?
1961.
Ah.
And I had a teacher named Mrs. Mayevsky. And Mrs. Mayevsky would pick out student work and block out the name on the work and project it as an example to the whole class. And you didn't know when she was doing that. If she picked yours, you didn't know if it was a negative example or a positive example.
So she actually put negative examples up there?
Yes.
Wow.
And she marked them up. And it was a less self-consciously correct time and more get the job done and show them what they should do and show them what they shouldn't do kind of approach to education. And it worked pretty well with me.
But you were sitting there, and if it were your paper and you knew it, the rest of the class didn't know it, but you didn't know whether this was going to be a good example or a bad example of the paper.
That's absolutely correct.
And so what did you do?
You tried very hard to not indicate that it was your paper.
Interesting. And she never said at the end.
Never.
Interesting.
But she did say at the end what she showed it was a good paper or a bad paper, which would become apparent in the course of the review.
So I take it you were a good boy and a good student, right? Because you wouldn't have been where you were if you weren't.
I was good at school, yep.
Yeah.
I was good at school.
And you are a very considered speaker. You're known throughout New York as the New York Times upstate quote. In other words, when you read a story about upstate politics, about legislative politics, gubernatorial politics, you're likely to see your name in the article or as likely as not. That's extraordinary, and I'm always proud to point this out to everybody. This is my friend, and to hope that some will come to me.
Well, it's a great acknowledgement, and I appreciate being asked, but I can't remember calling to express my view. I'm pleased that people call me, and it's not just the Times. Journalists call me from other places, too.
Now, you're a Republican, aren't you?
I have been all my life, yes.
Why?
Well, there are two elements to that answer. One is that I've always been a conservative person fiscally, not so much on the matter of social policy. In fact, when I got into politics, I got interested in innovation in social policy, and it was a good area for a Republican because most people weren't interested in it.
What does that mean? I'm so sorry. I'm a little slow. Innovation and social policy.
Well, I was appointed, I like to say, when I joined the Ulster County Legislature, I was appointed to the Mental Health Committee.
Sure.
And I thought that the guy who did that, who was the chairman and for whom I did not vote for chairman, did it because he thought I needed mental health attention. But no Republicans cared about, in Ulster County, cared much about social policy or cared about mental health policy.
Well, there weren't many votes there, right? I mean,
it wasn't the constituency.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of opportunity to work on those kinds of questions, and I got really interested involved in them. So one reason, my dad was an investigator when he was in the NYPD, and he was a detective. He was an investigator for a Republican state attorney general, so we had some family relationship. And so there was that. There was relationships inside the Republican Party in the city. There was Nelson Rockefeller, who was a progressive Republican, who I had enormous admiration for and who I later came to know a little bit. So being a Republican in the 60s and 70s, especially in New York, was a little different than being a Republican now. I have some Republican candidates I like a lot and who I support. Holly Conright, the district attorney in Ulster County, is a great friend, and a few others, but I'm not actively involved in partisan politics now.
What do you think has happened to the Republican Party with the Tea Party at all?
Well, it's not just the Tea Party, but it's the Republican Party has obviously, the center of politics in the country has gone rightward, and the Republican Party is to the right of the center, so the entire shift has been part of the story. And then because of the way American politics works, nominating politics works, that you've talked about a lot on the radio over the years, the more engaged and ideologically extreme dimensions of the party pull the party in an extreme in the Republican example, the rightward direction. And there's no winning elections in New York that way. So New York is demographically, socially, and many other ways different than the rest of the country. So the national trend has diminished the Republican Party in New York because of association.
So New York Republicans don't enjoy great approbation from the rest of the country.
No, New York Republicans are, it's a long time since Tom Dewey was the candidate for president, the Republican candidate for president.
And yet everybody who rides on the Thruway will know that he existed, the Dewey Thruway.
And that's a good thing.
You wrote how many books, Jerry?
16.
16 books, okay.
Wrote or edited.
What were they?
Or, do you want me to go
let me do
from
it better.
The present going backwards or from
the beginning to the present?
Well, a couple books on Nelson Rockefeller to start out with, a large number of books and studies on New York Constitution and New York government, books on race in New York City. My first book was on race and human rights in New York City, a recent book on legislative process with Dan Feldman, another recent edited book called The Oxford Handbook of New York State Government and Politics. So generally about New York. A book about regionalism in New York City.
What is that, regionalism in New York City?
Well, regionalism, and it's called Regionalism and Realism, and it's the idea of how local government reform can be achieved in the downstate, three-state area, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. I think it's an interesting book. It has a couple chapters on New York City being conceived as a regional government, which it was, and the limits of it as a regional government.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm a little slow. A regional meaning, in this case, when you put Queens and Manhattan and Brooklyn together, these were all different regions?
Well, more than that, Long Island City, Brooklyn was a city and a county. There were lots of towns and some villages in what is now New York City, and we created one great metropolitan government in this five-county area, much of which was farmland. And the idea was even that it might expand. There was even an idea that it would expand into parts of New Jersey, which was, of course, blocked by the U.S. Constitution. So we currently have discussions. I work a lot on questions of regional approaches to government, the question of how many governments there are, how to get them to cooperate on things.
To put it mildly, there are too many of them. And you always say, we got to get them to cooperate. And along comes Papa Cuomo. He says so. George Pataki, I think, says so. And Junior Cuomo, Andrew Cuomo says so.
Everybody says so.
And it doesn't happen.
Alfred E. Smith.
Why is that? Why didn't it happen? Why doesn't it happen?
Well, the fundamental reason is, I think, psycho-emotional. I think that people conflate. They associate their idea of community with their municipal entity. So if you say you can't have that municipal entity, they think that you're attacking their idea of community. So that's a one big question. Another point is that they're not convinced that the benefits that you claim will accrue from reducing the numbers of governments will actually accrue, and that's often a reasonable point of view. So that's a second concern. And I think that the status quo is very powerful. It's much harder to change the status quo than maintain the status quo in all areas of life. Certainly in government structure, there's no exception. So those are a few of the reasons.
So you're invested in this. You've been invested in this from the very beginning. You advised almost everybody on it, but it doesn't happen. Is that personally frustrating for you?
Well, it happens sometimes. You know, one of the great successes, and this is going to sound almost funny, but one of the great successes in government reform is how we deal with garbage. You know, it used to be that every town and village had a dump. Now we have regional facilities, many of them county-based, but sometimes broader-based, and we deal with solid waste in a much different way. Now, we haven't fully gotten to the best process, in my opinion, but that's an area of change that's been very significant. That's because state incentives were put in place, the environmental movement supported it, there was political leadership, there was a social argument for environmental sensitivity and solid reform in solid waste. So there are success stories. They're mostly functional. They're not removing structures. They're getting functions to be handled collaboratively or in different ways than they were before for reasons of economy or for other value-driven reasons.
Now, in New Paltz, where, of course, you were the dean and now the regional vice president and everything, they've taken it all on, right? They collapsed the town and a village.
In fact, we've never achieved that, and that's been a source of frustration to me. Sometimes places don't join because they're distinct socially and economically from each other.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Sometimes they don't join because of bias, racial or ethnic bias. Sometimes they don't join because the people who live next to the city spent much of their life escaping from the city, and now they don't want to be reconnected to it. Not just talking about New York City, but some smaller upstate cities. Kingston and the town of Ulster would be a good example in Ulster County. But in New Paltz, we have made a very strong effort over several years, but we haven't convinced the community that there will be a benefit for everybody. One of the big issues is the fear of shift of the tax burden from people living in the village to people living outside the village. We've been able to demonstrate that that shift wouldn't occur and that state resources are available to mitigate that impact, but we haven't made the case well enough or in compelling enough a way to convince the community to do it.
Jerry Benjamin, who we are talking to, let's talk a little bit about the things that we have in common, one of which is our time at New Paltz together, which was a long, long time. You know, it's interesting that when I read your bio, I said among the most notable of the revitalized New Paltz curriculum was the interdisciplinary major in Asian Studies. Now, I think I remember that when I came to New Paltz had been named as the Asian and African Studies Center of the University. And when you and I took a look at the situation when we were in the political science department, we sort of decided we were going to be the state legislative center and the state government center, and we did it. We didn't ask anybody. We just did it. We started the internship program together. We started the Legislative Gazette program together, which we're still doing. And in fact, to this day, as the head guy there, I report to you.
That's a formal matter.
Yeah, well, it may be. But the fact is that you do play a tremendous role in all of that. And we did what we said. And Rockefeller, of course, had sort of designated SUNY at Albany to be the political center. But we did it. What does that tell you?
Well, it's a great lesson for anybody who needs to provide institutional leadership, and that is build your strengths. You hire good people, you find what their strengths are, and you create unique and powerful institutional centers or activities based on their strengths. Now, what happened with Asian and African studies is that through a period of fiscally difficult period, in a time where the faculty wanted to be organized on a disciplinary basis, they atrophied, they diminished. And when I came to be dean, I thought we had a great opportunity to build on some of the strong people we still had. Ron Knapp in geography is the principal example. To renew that at a time where there was renewed interest in Asia. So we did Japanese, we did Chinese, we hired people in the departments who cared about Asia, and we really
But Jerry, you hired the right people.
Right, and we had, and part of that was convincing a department, you know, they'd say, I want a historian, and I say, wouldn't it be nice to have a historian of China? Leadership requires goals and purposes. They have to be rational, they have to be in accord with the institutional's commitments and needs, but you also have to have to identify potential strengths that in people that they're not even sure about. Let me give you an example. We have an Institute of Disaster Mental Health at New Paltz.
An Institute of Disaster Mental Health. Okay. And what is that?
It's a planning for mental health impacts of man-made and natural disasters. So after people are flooded and affected by, we work in the Middle East. We have been in the Middle East for 3 years trying to help people deal with post-traumatic situations with their children and with families that are affected by conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And what we do is help people prepare and understand that it's not just rebuilding houses and the physical environment, but also rebuilding lives and dealing with the consequences, not only for the people who are affected by disasters, but by the people who respond, because there are extreme consequences for them. James Halpern, a leader of our program, responded to Newtown, and he had to counsel families who lost their children and their siblings. And we're uniquely situated in New York State to help prepare people to do that. Well, the reason that we are is that James was a first responder at 9/11 for the American Red Cross. And then he came to me and talked to me about how he wanted to build up the clinical capacity of our psych department. He was not the head of the department, but he's a clinical psychologist. And I said, well, why don't we build on your experience? So here we had a person who had been involved in one of the most traumatic events in modern American history. He knew what to do. He was trained, and we could internalize that resource and bring that resource into the service of the university, into the service of the people of the state. But insofar as I would claim leadership in that, it was recognizing the potential of the person in the moment. And so that's what being dean is all about.
Well, being dean is a lot more than that. When we first got to New Paltz over the years, we had some wonderful people who we worked with. But there were also some people who were not as strong or who were there for a long time, had given it up, whatever. When you're a dean, you've got to say no a lot, don't you?
Yes, you do have to say no. And the way you say no is by talking to people and saying there's something you want to do or some object you want the school to pursue. And there are a lot of requirements upon the school. And I want you to know that I value you and you're in a long-term relationship with me and with the school. And I'm going to look for lots of opportunities to support what you want to do, but I can't do this. No has to be contextualized by a sense of value and also a sense of possibility over time. And people have to believe that. And the way they believe that is by not testing you in a kind of traditional way, but making a judgment about whether you're worthy of trust and whether they can come back to you another time and they'll get fairly treated and fairly considered and maybe hear yes. These are relationship issues. They're not cold, hard, no or yes questions. And every decision has to be evidence-based. It has to be based upon your thoughtful consideration of the idea and your weighing of the equities. And you're making a judgment and being able to explain it.
Well, yes, that's all very nice. But every once in a while, you find somebody who really is a rule breaker. You know, I can think of a couple of examples that we went through, one of whom, falsified his vita over a number of years. When that kind of thing happens, you know, you have to take extreme action.
You have to remove the person.
Yeah.
And you enter in. I'm still in litigation over a personnel action I took when I was dean 6 years ago.
Right.
So, you know, you have to accept the consequence. When I became a dean, I was told by the outgoing dean that the person who would be my principal assistant was not a capable person. And I said, how long has she been working for you? And he said, 4 years. She's up for permanent appointment. So I was left with the decision to not give the person a permanent appointment, which I did. And I explained to her why I did that. And it's in the nature of the university and of state service that that person continued to work for me for a year after I had given her that news. So that was not a happy situation.
Jerry, let's talk a little bit about politics, if we can. We have an upstate region. Upstate is defined by many people in many different ways. Some people think upstate begins at Yonkers or Mount Vernon. Others think of it, you know, as the extreme greenlands of New York. But we've had all of these years a Republican Party for one reason or another, even though in the minority in terms of the number of New York State Republicans who were in charge of the Senate. And that added a certain amount of balance to the way things were. We had an assembly, which was New York City. Once it went, it really went big. It became a New York City place. Now it looks like, and you're the senior political analyst that I know, now it looks like the Senate is going to go Democratic. I happen to believe that the reason it hasn't gone earlier is that the governor is happy about having a Republican buffer. But now we're about to see, if we're to believe what we're reading in the papers, a Democratic Assembly, a Democratic Senate, and a lot of people are saying that's going to make for an unbalanced state. What do you think?
Well, I agree fundamentally. We have a Democrat-elected Senate now. We just don't have the Democrats in the same conference. We have two Democrat conferences, the independent Democrats and the so-called regular Democrats.
But now, there are some people who think that's Andrew Cuomo's doing.
But we have elected, people have gone to the polls and elected a majority who had the label Democrat, of members who had the label Democrat, in districts designed by Republicans.
Right.
Those districts were designed by Republicans.
Right.
So it's not a stretch to expect that there'll be more Democrats elected than Republicans in the coming election, although the Republicans are working very hard to try to resist that. It's even more interesting because when the Republicans controlled, they had seats, four or five or six seats in the city, in New York City, so they had to be, historically, they had to be responsive, so they were moderated by that presence. They had a presence on Long Island, a core on Long Island, they had a presence in the city, and they had the upstate rural districts. Now, the Democrat conference in the assembly is dominated by city and suburban members, but they have a significant number of upstate members. So there's an internal dynamic that goes on there to some degree. But I think that the way things work now will make New York even more dominated, New York state politics even more dominated by downstate interests. And I think that's bad. Just as when New York state politics was dominated by rural upstate districts, that was bad and unfair. And I've been writing more and more about that. Because I used to think, you know, there are two kinds of upstate guys who started out in Brooklyn. There are those guys who are in exile from Brooklyn, and there are those guys who become upstaters. And by some concatenation of circumstance, as Malcolm Wilson would say, I became an upstater. And I think that leadership is, statewide leadership is cut off for upstaters. I think that consideration of upstate life is less compelling than it should be in the political leadership of the state, and I think that it's more and more the case in the legislature as it is in statewide elected office, and I think that's bad. I think that a boy who's born in Canandaigua should have the same realistic possibility of becoming governor of New York as a boy born in the Bronx, and it's not so, and that's bad.
You had a plan, I think it was a Swiftian modest proposal, to change the way in which we count votes, because in some districts, so few people come out. For example, in the Bronx, I know of elections where 300-something thousand people are in a Senate district and only 5,000 vote. And you think that that should be disincentivized. Is that right?
Right. I just published an essay in the TU that didn't get universal acclaim from
the
left.
Was your tongue in your cheek?
I pointed out, let me defer my answer to that specific, I pointed out that there were the four districts that had the least people voting for the assembly in 2012 added up, that number of people added up was under 65,000 people. And there was one district in suburban Rochester that had 66,000 voters for the assembly. So in effect, those voters, if you count voters and not people, which—
In other words, you don't count how many people are in the district
right.
or are eligible to vote, you
right.
count actual votes.
Or how many people in the district who are
yeah.
children or whatever.
Yeah.
Those 65,000 voters down in New York City chose four members, and those 66,000 voters in upstate New York chose one member. And so why aren't more of those downstate people voting? Well, some of them aren't citizens. We know that we know that their economic and social correlates to non-voting, their age-related correlates to non-voting. But I think that we should be incentivizing voting, and one way we could do that is by giving people more power in the legislature who are chosen by more people. So I suggested, I guess it's fair to say, a Swiftian proposal that we could weight votes in the legislature so that people who are elected in districts that attract more votes have more voting power in the legislature. Now, some may say that that's unrealistic, but in fact, we have—
Some being me, and you know it.
In fact, we have weighted voting in many upstate rural legislators, and we have in one, I believe in Port Jefferson, we have a voting system that allows the people who are voting to distribute their votes in a way that results in elected officials who reflect the diversity of the community. So it's possible systemically. And I think we should be thinking more about that. And we should, if we did that, we would encourage downstate politicians to get more people to vote because they'd have more power.
Yeah, but why in the world? I mean, you're a real politic guy. With the people in the New York State Assembly, all those Democrats vote for a system that would clearly hurt them.
That's why we have a constitutional convention possibility, so that we can change the rules when they don't work. In 1964, when New York City was being subordinated by a system that Al Smith called constitutionally Republican, the U.S. Supreme Court changed the system. Now the people who vote in upstate New York are being subordinated, and we don't think a thing of it. We think it's fair because we don't think, and we think it's fair that people who don't vote and have no incentive to vote are equally consequential politically as people who do vote.
So how come people don't vote in New York City and do vote upstate?
Well, one reason is that there's not a heck of a lot of competition. Another reason is that...
What do you mean by that?
That the Republican Party is of little consequence in New York City.
But you still have primaries.
Well, but primaries occur at times where people are not expecting elections. They're low turnout because they usually occur in the summer or fall. And they can be competitive, but they're competitive in a way that doesn't encourage high motivation. We have to motivate participation on the general election day. Now, do I think this proposal is going to be adopted? No. Do I think that I can provoke thinking? Yes. I've provoked outrage by suggesting to people that we should count people who vote, the consequence of people voting more so as to encourage other people to vote.
So what was the outrage based on? I mean, what were your opponent?
Well, one guy said that my research was no good. That really hurt. But in fact, I did make one mistake in the essay, so he was right about that. Yeah. Doesn't Benjamin understand that people who don't vote are as entitled to representation as people who do vote? And my answer is, what is the obligation of the citizen? I'm not going to do what you expect of me, but you got to give me what everybody else gets. Doesn't strike me as a reasonable position.
Jerry, we've had a very interesting time here in New York State recently, in which there has been something called the Independent Democratic Conference, IDC, who came over to make coalition with the Republicans to create a Republican majority, even though it was supposed to be balanced and they were supposed to be co-equal, but they weren't. And so now we have the governor going before the Working Families Party and getting booed and getting saved when he promised to separate out the Republicans from the Democrats and bring the Democratic five guys back over to the Democratic conference. You know, I've always believed that the reason that those five guys or four guys were there was that Andrew Cuomo allowed it to happen or even encouraged it to happen. Can't prove it, but I believe it. And now there's Cuomo. He says, okay, guys, get back where you belong. Can you sort of parse that situation for us?
Well, I think you're starting in the wrong place.
Fine.
I think that...
Just fine.
It doesn't mean that your conclusion is wrong. But we have to start from the first time the Democrats in modern history that the Democrats got a majority in the Senate and they proved entirely incapable of governing.
We call it a circular firing squad.
Right. And so the members who separated were in that, were mostly, I don't think entirely, but I have to check, in that group that failed to govern, failed to select effective leadership, were at the effect of corrupt members who later proved to be corrupt, who were trying to trade for personal advantage. And so that's part of the experience of people departing from the conference. I also think the internal tensions in the Democrat conference are important. I think there are racial and ethnic differences in the conference. I think there are questions about who can get to enter into the leadership. And I think that's part of the calculation of the people who might be, who people like Senator Klein, who might be frustrated in his desire to be a leader in that conference. And it's a less discussed matter, but it needs to be forthrightly confronted. This is a diverse state. Opportunity has to be open to all to lead, but it has to remain open to all once leadership shifts, perhaps from a person from one ethnic or racial group to another. So that's part of it. Why did this separation occur? I think the separation occurred because of frustrations with the conference, but also because of power considerations by people who wanted to be powerful in New York and saw no path in the conference, and encouraged by the Republicans who are, as we pointed out earlier in this conversation, diminishing in their capacity to retain any serious hold on the Senate. Then could the governor, once this happened and advantages came to those relatively few, I wrote this kind of interesting stuff about theoretical stuff about three-way negotiations, how coalitions get formed. Forgive me, but research in anthropology called triad research. It's called the mother-in-law problem. You know, what happens when three people are in a relationship rather than two people in a relationship? The negotiation shift. But the point that you make is valid. The governor found some advantage in this circumstance and was able to exploit the circumstance. He's good at that. And when he found that it was essential for his ambition and his reelection from his point of view and the character of his reelection that this circumstance ended, he committed himself to end it. What's interesting to me, and I think is insufficiently considered so far, I know you've talked about it, but it is under what conditions did this group agree to come back, and will those conditions be realized? Are they going to remain a separate conference that is in coalition with the main conference with joint leadership as we've had before, but the joint leadership will not be with the Republicans, it will be with the regular Democrats, and what will that look like? I think that's a prospect and an expectation of I don't think the IDC expects to go away. And if we do have that unfolding, what will the size and character of the IDC be? Will others join it?
We'll remind everybody the IDC is this group of Democratic senators who went over to join the Republicans in coalition. They became committee chairs. In some cases, they got more money in some cases. And now, because the governor and Mayor de Blasio, by the way,
right,
big issue here, has said, you guys get back where you belong. Let's talk about de Blasio for a moment and his relationship with Andrew Cuomo. He is now regarded as the sort of populist progressive mayor compared to the more conservative Andrew Cuomo. In the beginning, it looked like Cuomo was going to clean his clock on things like charter schools and other issues. Now it seems to be a more equal relationship. And there are those people who think that when Cuomo went before the Working Families Party and almost didn't get that nomination from them, which could have cost him in prestige and votes and the way in which he was perceived, that he was in real trouble. De Blasio comes in like Lochinvar out of the West and saves Cuomo's hash.
Well, I guess the Scottish verdict applies to de Blasio, not proved. You know, it's early innings. There's a Democrat, left-center Democrat constituency in New York that's been out of power a long time, 20 years. He's brought that constituency into power. He has a genuinely diverse predisposition to diversity in government, and he's doing some very interesting, appointing some very interesting people who've been, and I think some quite able people. But I would bring to your attention a book called City Limits by a guy named Peterson that we used to assign in the 80s. Cities are not sovereigns. They are limited in their resources.
They are creatures of the state.
They can be diminished rapidly and effectively if they overreach. And I'm a little concerned about the cost and consequence of the choices that are being made in the city.
Your father was a cop.
Right.
People are concerned about their safety.
Right.
De Blasio gets elected and he comes in on a program of stop and frisk.
Right.
Which clearly, if you have that black skin and you get stopped all the time, whether you're a lawyer or whatever else, was not a good idea. On the other hand, there are now a spate of crimes going on in New York City, which are making both the police commissioner, I think, Bratton, somewhat more defensive, and the mayor. I've always felt if crime goes up in New York City, de Blasio's a one-term mayor. Is that true?
Well, it depends on what else happens, for example, in housing, which is a critical area, and a number of other social areas. But crime is critical, and the transformation of the city, of daily life in the city that you and I experienced from the 70s or the 60s till now, your capacity to go into Central Park and enjoy the day without fearing that you'll be mugged. Ability to walk back from the movies at 12:30 at night with a feeling of safety and security in the street, your capacity to park your car with more than a 50% chance that you'll find all the parts of it when you pick it up the next day. In fact, car vandalism has diminished massively in the streets of New York, partly because of technology, partly because of enforcement. So I think you're right. I mean, public safety is a test.
Well, you compared that to housing. I don't know that everybody cares about housing the way that everybody cares about personal safety.
Well, Alan, if you're in Williamsburg and you're being asked for rent $3,500 a month, then you care a lot about housing. If your future turns on succeeding in a lottery, so the new moderate income housing is available to you, your capacity to live in the city is contingent on your capacity to afford it. And I think that The nature of schools is another big issue. You know, he's challenged the charter school movement.
You mean de Blasio?
De Blasio. And kids, if your kids can't get educated, you're not going to live in the city. You can't afford to housing. You can't. There are a number of social initiatives that are consequential. And the question is, can he be effective in those areas without breaking the bank, without driving the resource base out of the city?
And without... You know, I mean, look, let's face it. We have housing projects in New York. Some of the greatest crime is in these housing projects. People hear housing and they say, oh, brother, here we go again. And I'm sort of saying, but the people, whether they're black or white or Hispanic, who live in those housing projects, they know what crime is all about. And the crime, it seems to me, becomes much more important than the conceptual idea, does everybody have a place to live?
Well, I can't argue with that. I don't have evidence one way or another, and certainly it's important to me that I can walk
around.
That's
the difference between you as a political scientist and me.
It's certainly important to me to feel safe when I go out in the street.
Okay. So, Jerry, I've often wondered, following up on that, how come, because you mentioned it earlier, people in poorer districts don't vote? Now, that's interesting to me because some of the people who have the most to gain from the intervention of government do not vote, and therefore they're disregarded. What's that about?
Well, the two major correlates of voting are education and age, from the studies that I've read. Within those categories, the lesser affluent, and race, by the way, has become a lesser factor. And African Americans and whites are voting at about the same rates. Hispanic people are voting at lesser rates. But that's partly recent acquisition of the vote.
But that's going to change.
Going back to my graduate school, and this is going to be grossly problematic. But you know, you could say, well, people are happy, so they're not voting, but they're satisfied. That's probably not so.
In the ghetto or in the housing projects where people don't vote,
right.
They're not happy.
Right. So they're dissatisfied or they're alienated or they don't think that their vote is consequential. But there's another dimension to it. The institutions that used to mobilize the vote don't mobilize the vote. If you're elected in an election where there's, you know, the political party organizations are ineffective in neighborhoods. They're marginal in neighborhoods. And in small towns too, but if you're a politician and 10,000 people are voting and you have no opposition and you are getting reelected, why would you want 20,000 people to vote or 30,000 people to vote? You're perfectly comfortable with not mobilizing more people, but having the comfortable constituency that supports you. So you need some discomfort. So that arises from designing a system that creates greater competition in districting and creating incentives for people to participate and contest elections.
Which raises the next question, and so we're running out of time here, and I could go on with this for 3 hours with you. But what about public financing of elections?
There are two big reforms that I think are fundamentally important. One is public financing, and the other is fair districting. And the constitutional amendment on the ballot right now for redistricting is not fair districting. It gives the appearance of reform without reform. The New York Times editorialized on it this week.
I couldn't agree with you more. Okay. In other words, the governor is saying, I arrived at this deal, it's going to make things better, but it doesn't. And it puts it off into the future.
Now coming, and this will put the lie to the presumption about Republicans, coming to public financing, my view is derived from my father and mother, who you started this conversation about, saying that to open the door of this store, we have to turn on the lights, we have to turn on the heat, we have to pay the electric bill. That's the condition of being in business. Now, the condition of being in business in a democracy is to have fair elections, to pay for the overhead of being in business, of having a democratic society. So we have to pay collectively for our elections because that's the necessity for democracy. We have to reject the argument that somehow if we're paying collectively for elections, we're supporting some individual's career who we may or may not agree with. We're not. We're supporting a system that's fair, a choice environment that's fair. And this failure to define the conversation in that way is the fundamental failure of reform. Now, I know reformers, I've been involved with this, with the Brennan Center, with Citizens Union, I've been on committees and so on. Reformers know this, but the frustration is that the citizens have been so kind of turned off by instances of corruption and what they regard as self-dealing and a certain cynical attitude toward public life, that they won't accept that you have to pay for democracy to have democracy out of the collective resource. And it doesn't have to be a lot, you know. And part of it is that the Supreme Court, in my opinion, has framed and constrained us from doing the right thing in such a fundamental way.
The Republicans in the state Senate are arguing against public financing of elections. I heard one senator saying, the people won't put up with our paying for our own elections.
Well, that's precisely the point that I'm arguing. That's not what it's about. You know, the outcome of most debates and conversations or differences about policy turn on the premises. And the premise, the definition of the premises in this debate has been misleading and undermining of what I think is a correct policy and the correct path.
Okay, so are we better off now than we were when you were writing books about Rockefeller and all the other governors, or have we slipped to a dangerous place?
From the point of view of my personal experience, I think it's kind of extraordinary what New York has provided for me and my family and my brother and my from our generation. What I fear is that we have lost our understanding of the proper role and function of government and of public life in society, and I think that our capacity to engage in reasoned discourse and come to decisions by compromise in our institutions is diminishing, and the nature of our discourse is getting vituperative and personal and really ugly. So I worry about going forward an institutional arrangement that is already designed to be constraining being further damaged or undone by the nature of discourse in modern, the nature of debate and discourse in modern society. It's predisposition to extremes, it's disposition to seek easy and often non-rational outcomes because they're attractive emotionally.
You want to amend the Constitution in a number of ways. You want a constitutional convention, which I think many of us think have been failures in the past. What is your hope that we can do?
I'm with Jefferson that the tree of liberty needs to be renewed from time to time. I think that we are no less capable of redefining our institutions to meet our current needs, and that we don't have to accept the constraints of the past if they make no sense to the contemporary moment. I also think that we have a profoundly conservative process for changing our fundamental institutions. We have to decide to do it. We have to pick people to do it. We have to produce a result, and we have to review the result to see if it's acceptable. So it's not a high risk, but it's a potentially high benefit. Our institutions aren't working effectively and well. We can do better in a lot of ways, and we ought to give it a try.
That makes you an optimist. There are those who see the glass as half empty.
I believe in the capacity of people to build better institutions and a better life, yes.
Jerry Benjamin, looking back on what you've done so far, and I'm sure you have a great deal more to give us, has it been a good life?
I had a friend in graduate school who said, you should write 5 or 6 things down on a piece of paper, put them in a box, put that box in a drawer, and open it up in 40 years and see how it came out. And I think if I had done that, which I had not, I would be pleasantly surprised at the degree to which my life experience has conformed to my hopes.
You have traveled the world. You are respected everywhere. People call on you. Governors call you on the phone and other people and ask for your advice. Did you ever think that was going to happen?
No. And when you talked about the Times, when I first read my name in the Times, I couldn't believe it. I was in the Hamptons at my brother's house, and I picked up the paper and I said, the reporter said, this was in the early 80s, he said, a longtime observer of New York politics, Gerald Benjamin remarked, and that was 35 years ago.
and your time, and your name is, and your name has been in the Times again and again. We've been talking with Gerald Benjamin, director of the Center for Research, Regional Education and Outreach, and associate vice president for regional engagement at the State University of New York at New Paltz. Jerry, first of all, I mean, I know, and I hope you take this in the right way, I truly love you, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, Alan, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Shartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.